Hi everyone, welcome to Lab Medicine's podcast series. My name is Kelly Swales. I'm the web editor for Lab Medicine magazine. Today with me I have Dr. Hui Pham, and he's going to talk a little bit about study designs. Now, Dr. Pham, this is going to be the first podcast in a series discussing the topic of study designs. For research, what are the common study designs?
So you know that we have seen a lot of study designs that talk in the people use in the medical literature. The common study designs are randomized control trial, or RCT, cohort study, and case control study. And today we are only going to talk about the RCT, the classical randomized control trial. We will discuss about all the type of study designs like cohort or case control study in the subsequent podcast.
I know that RCT has received a lot of attention in the news, mostly from the results of phase 3 randomized controlled trials. What are the differences between clinical phases and why is RCT important?
Let me first tell you about the difference in the clinical trial phases. So you know that before they can even go to phase 1 clinical trial, they have to have like evidence or data from animal study to suggest that the new method, the new intervention, or the new medication actually will be promised to work. And then after that, they would go to the phase 1 clinical trial. It's typically conducted in a very, very small subset of healthy volunteers, usually about 10 to 20 people, and who are given a single dose of medication or a very short course of the intervention, and one at a time, most of the time, or in a two or three people at a time, but very small group, to follow, to see the role of this phase 1 trial is to see whether the new compound or the new medication is safe in human and to establish the maximum tolerated dose. So phase 1 clinical trial is emphasis on the safety aspect. And after that, if the compound is deemed to be safe in humans, we will proceed to phase 2 trial, which enroll more patients in order to obtain further evidence about the safety of the new treatment. So again, safety is the issue here. In addition, another goal for phase 2 is to see any promise regarding the efficacy outcome in order to proceed to phase 3. So phase 2 is again safety and look for promises, efficacy outcome. If the compound is safe and if there is the promise about efficacy, then they would go to the phase 3 clinical trial. This is the rigorous formal RCT that will provide sufficient evidence to change the clinical practice and to permit the adoption of the new intervention or medication. It is designed to answer one single clinical question comparing to the control. That means the placebo control or the standard of care treatment. Is the new intervention beneficial, weighting both of its benefits and safety? So this phase 3 will provide us with the decisive evidence to know whether the intervention is beneficial or not. This is the one that you always see reported in the major medical journal. And if it is efficacious or and both safe, then the new medication will get FDA approved, hopefully, and phase 4 trial are just post-marketing of the new medication or intervention. It looks at unexpected rare adverse event that might have been missed in phase 3 clinical trial, or it might look for new uses that might be beneficial. So in this talk, we only focus about the phase 3 classical clinical trial that you see in the major medical journals. And the RCT is very important in clinical research because it is the most rigorous way to answer a clinical question. However, it does not mean that the RCT are easy to conduct, or they are inexpensive, or is it always possible to do an RCT, and some RCT are not well conducted. And it does not mean that most research questions can or should be investigated by RCT, and that most approach, or that all the approach are not indispensable or to successful clinical research. And another thing that RCT is important because it has a unique methodology. It is a formal experiment comparing to other clinical research that we will discuss later, such as, you know, like case control or cohort study.
So when should an RCT be conducted?
So you know that RCT is very, very expensive to conduct. And whenever it should conduct well. And to a trial on RCT should never be conducted if it doesn't meet the following criteria. In order to conduct a trial, there must be a clinical equipoise concerning the clinical question. Like a clinical equipoise mean that there is a genuine uncertainty on the medical community about the comparative therapeutic merits of each arm of the clinical trial, whether we know the intervention works or not. And then, if conducted, and if the result, what we decide, like if we get the result, then the result needs to be successfully disturb the clinical equipoise and to change the clinical practice. So before you decide a RCT or conduct an RCT, you should know that there is a clinical equipoise, and this RCT will provide enough decisive evidence to change the clinical equipoise and to change the clinical practice.
So what are the unique design features of an RCT?
So you know that RCT is totally different. It has a unique methodology comparing to other clinical study designs. In general, RCT have seven defined features to protect against the biases, which we can discuss later. The seven features are: one, it's a prospective study. Second, it had one or more intervention arm. Third, because RCT is an experiment, therefore it will have a control arm. The control can be either placebo control or it can be a standard of care at this time. And fourth, it will have a randomization aspect of that. That means the patient will be randomized to either receive the control or to be allocated to the new intervention arm. And it should be double blind if possible. But in some clinical scenario, you cannot have a double blind RCT. For example, if the new intervention is a surgical procedure, it is very, very difficult to decide a double blind study if the intervention is a surgical procedure. And sixth, the statistical analysis of the RCT should be intended to treat. And seventh, the RCT should have the mechanism to minimize the loss of the follow-up rate, because this is very, very important, as we will see later when we discuss about why intention to treat analysis is very important in RCT. And these seven features are very unique to the design of the RCT that you don't see in other study designs. The unique feature make the RCT the gold standard to provide a sufficient decisive evidence to change the clinical practice.
So you mentioned biases a little bit ago. What are some of the biases and studies of intervention, and how can RCT help protect against those?
So you know that there are three types of systematic bias. Let me tell you a little bit about those. So the biases can arise between the intervention and the control group, either one at the beginning of the trial. For example, if the two groups, let's say in a simple RCT, two group, one intervention, one control, they might be different at the start because one group might have patients sicker than the other group, or the two groups become different. However, this difference is independent of the interventions as the study proceeds, such as the patient in one group might receive additional treatments because the physician happened to know that those patients are in the intervention group. Or the two groups might differ at the end of the trial, independent of the interventions. For example, if we have more sick patients, lost to follow-up in the control group, for example. So the RCT feature, the feature that we discussed a few minutes ago, help to protect against these biases. For example, the study is prospective, so it will avoid any recall or selection bias that's associated if instead of doing the RCT, you do a case control study, for example. Second, the randomization aspect, very important, because if successfully randomized, that means if the randomization works as expected, you will control for both the measured and unmeasured confounder at the baseline between the two groups. That means whatever the confounder, you will be divide. They will have the same in both intervention and control group. Therefore, the difference you observe at the end of the trial is only due to the intervention itself. And another aspect is the RCT, if possible, is a double-blind trial. So it helps to protect against the bias that the physician might give the patients in the intervention group additional treatment that help them to get better, let's say, independent of the intervention you want to look, so that it protects against the core interventions. And it also reserves the benefit of randomization because it minimizes both the conscious and unconscious bias during the trial arise from both the patients as well as the clinicians during the trial. And another aspect is the intention to treat analysis. It's like it has to protect against the bias. For example, its intention to treat is we use a non-parametric test to do the analysis in the RCT. It's called the re-randomization test. How we do the test is beyond the scope of this podcast, but quickly, this test creates a probability space which valid inference about the p-value can be made without any assumption about the distributions. So you know that, for example, in case control or in just discrete statistics, if you want to compare the two groups, you might end up using the t-test. And those t-tests assume that the underlying distribution is a normal distribution. For the RCT, there is no assumption about the distribution. So the distribution can be anything. That's why making intention to treat a valid inference test. However, there is a caveat. In order for this test to be valid, it depends on the preservation in the analysis of all randomized patients. Meaning, when you randomize, you analyze regardless what the patient is taking the medication. That means for all RCT, the intention to treat analysis is the only unbiased analysis to preserve the statistical property of the blind experiment. So when you randomize the patient, you analyze according to whatever the arm the patient randomized to. Compliance is not an issue. We just need to know the final outcome of each patient in order for this intention to treat analysis to be valid. However, if you do not have any mechanism to avoid loss of follow-up, then above a certain threshold, if missing data the trial result is not creditable. So RCT must have the mechanism to minimize the loss of follow-up in order for the result to be valid.
What sort of question can an RCT help to answer?
So for all RCT, they are designed in such a way that they only help to answer one single primary question. They can only answer one single primary question. For example, in the superior classical RCT, the primary clinical question had to be very specific. For example, the question could be, is the intervention B at the dose X in this population W better than intervention A at dose Y in reducing the outcome Z during the time follow-up T? So whenever you read a report of the RCT in major medical journal, you can always see the question is formatted in such a very detailed, specific way because RCT can only help you answer one single primary question. If you have two primary questions, you have two RCTs. The reason why RCT can only answer one single clinical question is because of the tight control in the design of the RCT for both type 1 and type 2 error. So as a clinician, as a consumer of the medical research result, we should only use the primary outcome in the RCT as the main result of the trial, decisive evidence whether to change our clinical practice or not. In addition, we should only look at the primary outcome analyzed using the intention to treat method. Secondary outcomes or the result using the as treated analysis should be used only for exploratory purposes. And those should not be used as the evidence to change the clinical practice. And similarly, should be done for the safety outcome. RCTs is only designed to control the errors for primary safety outcome using the intention to treat analysis, secondary safety outcome, or the safety outcome analyzed using as treated analysis are only used for exploratory purpose only.
Can you explain a little bit more about the error control mechanisms in RCT?
So as I said, that RCT is designed in such a way that both type 1 and type 2 errors are controlled very tightly because of the huge cost if we don't control for those errors. Let me go back and tell you more about type 1 and type 2 errors. So type 1 errors occur when we wrongly reject the null hypothesis. So it means that we claim something, the new intervention, the new medication is superior when in fact it's not superior comparing to the placebo or to the standard of care. So using this evidence from the RCT that the new medication will become the standard of care for many years in the future and the cost of those to the society as well as to the patients are enormous. Therefore, in any RCT, the type 1 error is controlled at a very tight number of 5%. In RCT, all of this type 1 is assigned to test for to test one single primary hypothesis to answer one single primary question for the primary outcome. The primary outcome can have a composite level, but they have to add it up to one single primary outcome in order to test this question in the RCT. Now, if you use all of your type 1 error of 5% to test this one single primary hypothesis, you have nothing left to look for the secondary outcomes test. So if we conduct statistical tests for secondary outcomes and we use those as evidence to change our clinical practice, our overall experimental Y design for type 1 error for that RCT is adding up. You know, you use 5% for your primary hypothesis testing, and let's say you have 6 secondary outcomes, each of them is tested at 5%. Your overall type 1 error is more than 30-35% already. They would exceed the conventional of 5%. Therefore, that is the reason why we only look at the primary outcome for our evidence to change clinical practice. The other error that RCT attempts to control is the type 2 error. Type 2 errors occur when we wrongly fail to reject the null hypothesis. That means that we do not accept an intervention when in fact that it is truly superior comparing to the standard of care. And if this is a rare disease, a lethal deadly disease, and then you have this intervention, but you don't control your type 2 error, and then you say that this intervention is not working, while in fact it is working, so it will result in an enormous cost to the patient. So we cannot do that either. So the conventional agreement is that the power, which is the complement of the type 2 error, have to be at least 80 to 90%, depending on the field. We pick 80 to 90% because we want to find a true difference that is clinically significant. If you go the power to like 99%, you will detect a difference that might not be clinically relevant or important. So, and whenever you increase the power, you increase the sample size. And that will result in a hugely added cost to run an RCT that detects a clinically insignificant difference. So in any RCT, the sample size is calculated before the trial is conducted to control the type 1 error overall at 5%, and type 2 error is between 10 to 20%, depending on what RCT, in what field you want to conduct.
Are there different types of randomized control trials?
Yes, there are a lot of different variation of the RCT designs. The classical design, the basic classical design, is the superior design that we are talking about right now to test whether the intervention is better than the standard of care or placebo treatment. In lab medicine or in transfusion medicine, what we commonly see is not the superiority design. We usually see the equivalent or non-inferiority design. For this design, because we want to see whether the new intervention is equivalent or at least as good as the established one. Let me tell you little bit about those two common deviations from the classical design. For the equivalent or non-inferiority design, we have to agree before the trial conducts. A margin of indifference is chosen. What is the margin that you are saying that the new intervention is okay comparing to the standard of care? For the equivalent trial, they test to see whether the new intervention is equivalent to the established one. The null hypothesis is that the new intervention is better or worse. That means they are outside of the indifference zone, the zone that you pick before the trial is conducted. The alternative hypothesis is the new intervention is in the indifference zone. It is a two-sided test in the indifference zone. For the non-inferiority trial, the alternative hypothesis is one-sided test, asking whether the new intervention is no worse than or at least as good as the established one. It is a one-sided test. So before you start thinking about designing an equivalent or non-inferiority trial, you should get a consensus on what is this indifference zone, because that is very, very important. And then this indifference zone needs to be clinically significant difference. You cannot pick a too very small margin, because maybe those are not clinically significant. Or you cannot pick a very big margin, because maybe what you want to see is actually less than that margin. So that would be very, very important for you to read to see what is their indifference zone is.
So when can a trial be stopped early?
Yeah, so when you decide and run a trial, it's unethical not to have the procedures to stop the trial early, because you never know when you start a trial. Maybe the trial will have an early emergent but decisive evidence of benefit, of harmful, or impossible to finish the trial, because we cannot invest on the money and on the human resource to run a trial that we know for sure that it cannot finish. We cannot recruit enough subjects to answer our clinical questions, for example. Or if the trial is decided to be run for 5 years, for example, but after 2 years, we know for sure that this intervention is very harmful. So we just cannot let the trial go till the end of 5 years. We had to stop it early. Or if we truly know that this medication works well, we cannot just let the subjects in the control group not taking this medication. And how we decide this, how we look at the evidence at the trial emerge, evolve, to know whether this is or not, will be based on statistical analysis, and we'll be using different advanced statistical methods that is beyond the discussion of this podcast. So it is very crucial for the people involved in the trial, the data and safety monitor board, to examine the efficacy and the safety data of the ongoing RCT, and to have the pre-specified criteria for both the primary efficacy and safety endpoint in order to terminate the trial early. If the trial cannot finish, impossible to finish, or the trial have evidence but decisive, early evidence but decisive evidence, say that the new medication is beneficial or harmful to the subject, we had to stop the trial early.
Dr. Pham, you've given us a lot of great information today about RCTs. Can you give me a few sentences to sort of summarize the important take-home points for our listeners?
Yes, I know that this podcast had a lot of technical information details on the RCT. And I would like to summarize in a few take-home points that I think they are very important when we reviewing or reading a report, the result of any RCT in any major journal. This is what we should look for. So first, we have to keep in mind that if done correctly, well conducted, well designed, RCT is the gold standard to show the benefit of an intervention compared to the established therapy. It should provide decisive evidence to change clinical practice. However, we know that not all clinical questions can be answered by RCT, because it cannot always be done. It's expensive. It's not easy to conduct. And not all clinical questions should be go to RCT. And we should keep in mind that there is only one single primary clinical question for each RCT. in the report of an RCT, where we read it in the major medical journal, we should pay attention to the result from the primary efficacy and safety outcomes that they analyze using intention to treat. And we should use the evidence from the intention to treat analysis for the primary safety and efficacy outcome as the decisive evidence to change the clinical practice. For all other outcomes reported in the RCT, such as secondary outcome or as treated analysis, we should treat those information for exploratory purpose only. Maybe the information should be used to decide the next RCT, and they should not be used at this time to change our clinical practice. We should keep in mind that RCT is a formal experiment. The detail of the experiment, including how to assess the primary efficacy and safety outcome and the plan for the statistical analysis, should be specified before the trial begins, and this should not be changed in the middle of the trial, if possible. So when we read the report, we need to look carefully whether they changed the protocol or not. If they changed, the result of the trial might not be credible. And we should always keep in mind that RCT is not the only way to answer a clinical question. However, if it is done, it is the most rigorous way to answer a clinical question because of its unique design and statistical analysis to control for both type 1 and type 2 error. And an RCT cannot be called successfully if it does not change the clinical equipoise of the clinical scenario that it's trying to answer. So to keep in mind, RCT is very unique, it's expensive, and we should look for it, and we should carefully read what the report say in the medical literature to decide for ourselves what result we can believe and what result we should not use to change our clinical practice.
Thank you, Dr. Pham, for talking with us today about RCTs. I know I found it very informative, and I hope that our listeners do as well. And I'm looking forward to learning about all sorts of other study designs in future podcasts.
Thank you very much for letting me talk about the RCT because it's very important for us as clinicians to know a little bit about its design and what result we should look for.
Thanks, Dr. Pham.
Thank you.